There is a great tradition out of Turkey, a Sufi folk character named Nasruddin. Nasruddin was known equally for his wisdom as he was for his foolishness. One of his students who sought him on a big question looked for him for years and finally found him in a small village in the center of town, sitting on a big pile of banana peels. No one knew why. Such was the way of Nasruddin. The student asked, "Nasruddin, I seek your advice. Please, this is the question that all humanity has been asking. What is the secret to the pursuit of happiness?" Nasruddin thought, yes, good judgment. The student thought, good judgment. How do you get good judgment? Nasruddin said, "Well, experience." "Ah," said the student, "experience, yes. And how do you get experience?" Nasruddin said, "Ha, bad judgment." If I was a wise minister, I would simply say, "Go forth and use good judgment." But I am a foolish minister, and I'm going to unpack that a little bit. I think there's some truth to that of life experience. Gives us all sorts of material for bad judgment and back and forth. And the secret to experiencing good judgment, I believe, is through friendship, through friends who steer us in the right direction and help remind us when we might be headed for another life experience we don't want to have. That might not be the best path to happiness. The problem is, right now, you can easily argue that we do not have enough friends, that our social networks have gotten too small. Social scientists have a recent studies that show that we're epidemic levels of loneliness. Almost 1 in 2 Americans say they are lonely or have been predominantly lonely. And that the primary cause is that they do not have the circle of friends with meaningful relationships that they yearn for. Loneliness coming from fewer social relationships, meaningful, fewer social conflicts basically means that we're experiencing more judgment and lower levels of happiness. See how that goes? Round and round, bad judgment, not happy, more friends helps. But factor in this. If we don't have a strong social network, our stress levels go up, way up. Evolutionary issue is at risk, in fact. Just as hunger compels us to seek out food, loneliness compels us to seek out groups for survival and protection. If we are feeling separate and isolated, our stress hormones go up, our physical health declines, our emotional health is at risk, our spiritual health is out the window. All interconnected. Is this a new phenomenon, the increase in loneliness? It appears to be yes. That prior generations did not experience these heightened levels of loneliness. So what do we do when we're feeling lonely? Some of us are wise and we come to church. Many of us get on the internet and turn to social media. And then we have a whole new layer of interesting interactions with our friends and problems. Social isolation and loneliness are influencing, according to our sociologist, an increase in anger and partisan splintering in society at large, and it's heightened on social media. We go to social media because we're feeling lonely and we want to connect to people, but what we meet is anger and partisanship, and then what happens? We feel more lonely and isolated. We don't have personal contact on social media, of course, and we're more likely to engage in breaking social norms and what's acceptable than if we were in face-to-face contact. We get caught in these vicious cycles. Other barriers to friendship are also very, very present on social media. That is, there are fundamental changes to our demographics and changes in their social norms that are heightened on social media that we may not be paying close attention to. And they are impacting our capacity to accept and truly celebrate diversity. I'm going to give you just two examples today. The reading from Marta Valentine about accepting her complexity is one example. She claims she is Puerto Rican, feminist, lesbian, and a Unitarian Universalist minister. What she also doesn't say is that she's a mother and a poet, a truth speaker, and a fabulous preacher. She is a multiracial, multicultural, multifaceted person who is a perfect example of the increase of what's changing in our demographics. And subsequently, we are being pushed past our comfort zone. We prefer simple categories. We like to keep things in nice little organized boxes so we can figure them out. But we're in a world that is more nuanced, more complex, multi-layered identities. And that makes us confused and uncomfortable. What it invites us to do is to engage in a time-consuming process of building a friendship with somebody in all of their complexity. It takes time building trust. And guess what social media doesn't invite us to do? Have patience. Social media is a medium for the impatient part of the population. Hit like, move on. Look at video, move on. How do you build depth in a multicultural world? Second example is the use of language and something as simple on a pronoun. And here we are all entering into some very interesting discomfort between the grammar folks and the people who just want to get it right. So, something as simple as he, she versus they is confusing us and tripping us up. But at the bottom line, what we're trying to do is honor the person who recognizes within themselves that gender is fluid. It's not binary. And they want to be honored in claiming he or she does not represent who I am and what I experience in my gender. So they invite us, please use they, or some people are using different spellings on she or he just to keep us even more on our toes. Merriam-Webster said, okay, we're going to do this. Noun, they, pronoun, accepted. The Oxford English Dictionary had already done that. Merriam-Webster was just falling in line. And our grammar historians say this is actually not new in literature. We've been using they on a regular basis. It was just the 20th century we tried to get really restrictive. But it's inviting us into a different relationship that our wee little brains are struggling with. This is not, I mind you, and I'm saying so, not an invitation to ask somebody who is saying, you please use they or she or they. This is not a time to say, tell me about your gender experience. That's personal. You don't do that in person and you don't do that on social media. It's kind of rude. I know you're curious. Wait for that friendship to bud and maybe they'll share their story with you. So all of this got me thinking in our theme of the month of interdependence. Interdependence. We're living in this multicultural, multi-layered, 21st century, high technology, social media world. What's the impact on us? Many people are celebrating the advent of the internet as the modern form of the interdependent web of existence. you could go with that. I could go with that, but we need to recognize where the problems are. The American Psychology Association published an entire issue on the studies that they're conducting on where some of the problems are. For example, social media, the loudest voice in the internet, when it impacts our happiness, mixed results, very mixed results. We know that in a good friendship, a certain level of self-disclosure is necessary, right? For depth, for meaningful, for longevity. We need to share who we are in an authentic way. Well, apparently on social media, we have limits, man. We have limits. Do not overshare. TMI, again and again. It belongs on a person-to-person relationship, not on your Facebook feed or Twitter account. Adolescent girls are prone to overuse social media when they are feeling negative emotions. They go to social media looking for empathy and compassion and affirmation, and then they get likes, and you think, well, that would help with empathy. It actually has the opposite effect. They are more at risk for depression. Something to really pay attention to if you have an adolescent girl. Now, if you're on this kind of social media thing and you like to watch other people's lives, right? Kind of a lurker. You like something and you watch how wonderful their vacation was, the wonderful meal they had last night. No insult to all of you who like to post that stuff. It's lovely. But if you're the kind of person that just keeps looking at that and then you're comparing yourself to them, which is what our brains do, you're actually at risk of lowering your happiness level because you don't measure up. We start to realize, well, I haven't had that good a vacation in a long time. And we start to feel less than and diminished. You can lower your self-esteem. Psychologists recommend promoting your own life, your own events in life. Figure out where your happiness is and share it with each other. And that builds our self-esteem and our self-image. What they've also recognized is that bias, no surprise, is rampant. Rampant bias, particularly with memes. We see prejudices popping up all over the place. But what's particularly troublesome is that when we see a meme that's packaged humorously, as a humor, as a funny, is the number of people who won't object because if it's packaged as humor, we think it's more socially acceptable. We don't object even though it's blatantly prejudiced or biased. Because, well, if I object and say this is rude, maybe they'll pile on me and say that I'm just being too uptight. That just actually encourages more bias and prejudice memes. So if social media is part of the problem, or it might be part of the solution, it really kind of depends upon how you use it, doesn't it? How many of us really pay attention to how we use it, with awareness and the impact of how it makes us feel? There are other places to turn. Marta Valentine offered a wonderful reading, and one of our favorite places to turn, pets. Did you know in the U.S., 70% of U.S. households have a pet? That's more than households that have children. And what are we doing with our photos of our pets? We post them, where we are seeking all sorts of love and affirmation for our pet and our wonderful relationship. Of course we do. How many of you have been caught on the dog and the dinosaur outfit on the Roomba? That one was going around for a long time. Yeah. I got caught with one with dog playing the piano and howling last week. That was a good one. It's a wonderful way to lift our mood a little bit with sharing our love. As Marta points out, pets, they help train us in deepening our compassion. Start with a plant, move your way up. And of course, we also turn to church. Church is the great experimental ground for how to be a human being. This is where we learn how to engage in conflict, how to engage in vision and mission. How do we learn to put theory into practice? So, of course, a church needs to stay relevant, keep learning and being on the cutting edge, because if we're going to learn about how to be happiness, this is a great place to experience life in your bad judgment. All will be forgiven. But, of course, how a church uses social media is so crucial. It's an important network tool. It's an important way for us to feel we're tied together, but without constricting ourselves. There's a good balance there. We can attract new members. Inviting people is the best way to expand this church. If you want to grow this church, invite your friends and neighbors. How many of us proclaim our faith as a Unitarian Universalist on social media, on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or any of the other new emerging social media sources? Proclaiming our faith to our friends and family. What an extraordinary way to grow who we are as Unitarian Universalists. It's also a great way to motivate for a call to action for social justice. It's a great way to find volunteers. And we, as a Unitarian Universalist, we are a small liberal religious movement. One of the things I love is that social media allows us to feel connected to Unitarian Universalists across the country and around the world. With our partner churches in Romania and in India, we get to see what they're doing on a regular basis. But what I found very interesting as I was researching about religion and social media and how they intersected was how little research is actually being done. These two massive institutions and events in our lives, very little hardcore quantitative data is being researched. It could be a bias of sociologists against religion. It could be they just don't want to get into an area that might be potentially full of conflict. But what it means is that there are very few quantitative studies that are telling us how to use social media for religion. But what it does indicate, I think, from experience, is that we're probably lacking in some new policies and covenants and how we're going to behave with each other, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, that somehow we figure out how we're going to be together as a community in a very public way. Lots of things to consider about with our happiness and social media. Of course, I encourage you to keep one foot in your community, but I also encourage you to put the social media source down and put another foot out there in nature with the trees. Go outside and take a deep breath. Perhaps keep a gratitude journal and then post it on Facebook. A lot of people are doing that, keeping gratitude journals for everybody else. I have one friend every Friday. She congratulates her circle. You got to Friday. Tell me a good story from your week. I kind of like that. A good story from your week. But if you remember nothing else about today's topic, I'll give you a story to bring it down to one word. It comes from an ancient story from China, from Cheng Kung. Cheng Kung was a man who was happy. Always happy. He lived in his compound with his wife and children and his nieces and nephews and brothers and sisters. The whole family in this compound were such happy people. The emperor got word about the happiness of Cheng Kung's family and came to visit. And he said, "What is your secret to happiness?" Cheng Kung didn't say a word, just picked up the paintbrush and went to the parchment and began dipping the brush and the ink to paint one word again and again. 100 times, Cheng Kung painted that word. Kindness. Kindness. The emperor said, "Ah, I got it." Picked up a paintbrush, dipped it into the inkwell, took a parchment, and made a proclamation. For all people to seek happiness, we must do as Cheng Kung and his family have and seek kindness. And he ordered that Cheng Kung would place this proclamation in the front gate of his family compound. And all would see it. Word got out across the country and people came from everywhere to visit Cheng Kung and say hello and get a sense. They came and they took pictures and they made selfies and posted on Facebook. Cheng Kung became so famous with that picture. It lives on today in every traditional Chinese kitchen as the kitchen god, celebrated every New Year by cleaning the kitchen. If you remember nothing else about how to behave and seek happiness, good friends lead to good judgment and kindness. See how this works? It goes around and around. Kindness, good judgment, friends, happiness. May it be so. Blessed be.